Welcome to Voices, a podcast about people. I'm your host, David E. Bowman, and in this episode, I spent some time talking with Bob Gilbreth, Chief Marketing Strategist at Bridge Worldwide and author of the book, The Next Evolution of Marketing, Connect with Your Customers by Marketing with Meaning. Listen along as Bob and I discuss what meaningful marketing is all about and why it's important to the success of your business. Bob Gilbreth is Chief Marketing Strategist at Bridge Worldwide, one of the largest digital and relationship marketing agencies in North America. Bob is also author of the excellent and insightful new book, The Next Evolution of Marketing, which advises marketing professionals to connect with customers by marketing with meaning. Bob, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I really enjoyed reading your book. It's incredibly relevant and offers up some very useful advice to business professionals seeking ways to drive results in this brave new world of digital marketing. So let's start off by just talking about what do you mean by marketing with meaning?
Well, the real idea of the concept is kind of taking a bigger look at where society and business and because of that, marketing is going. And I think what I've seen in my career in marketing, started off doing traditional work at Procter & Gamble, where worked on great products, and then my job as a marketer was also to make advertising. And we've all spent a lot of times, those of us who have been in the industry, making advertising that is becoming better and better at interrupting someone's media experience, whether they're reading a magazine or watching television, listening to the radio. And that's kind of been the model for the past, 50, 60 years to a lot of success, and a lot of brands have been built. But what's been happening in society and technology is people are now using technology that gives them control over what they see, hear, and read. And when you start giving people control, a funny thing happens is they start deciding that they don't want to pay attention to the advertising that used to be forced upon them, and they find different ways of skipping it. And whether it's DVRs with ad skipping or even things like listening to music on an iPod instead of the radio, you've got thousands of songs at your disposal, put it on shuffle, make playlists, and you don't need commercial radio anymore. And that's pretty much the trend that's happening across all media. People are getting what they want when they want it and not having to pay attention to the advertising that we try to foist upon them. And really what's happening is there's kind of a crossroads, and every business is taking a different direction. Some businesses are trying to find new and, quote, innovative ways to interrupt people, whether it's ads on gas pumps, ads on stadium turnstiles. I've even seen an example of ads on sheep in a field. And they're trying to find different ways to kind of get in front of people's eyeballs. But at the same time, others are saying, hey, in a world where we can't interrupt people anymore, maybe the only thing we can do is to create marketing that they choose to engage with and advertising that itself improves people's lives. And that's something I've been noticing for a while and really kind of try to put together a look at that idea, which we call marketing with meaning. And meaning being people find it useful, people find some meaning or purpose out of it. And to really kind of lay out for traditional marketers like myself, a way for them to move their businesses and organizations toward this, what I think really is that next evolution of marketing.
And one of the books that you cite in The Next Evolution of Marketing is Seth Godin's Permission Marketing. And that's another one of my favorite books. And I think your book does a nice job of sort of taking the premise that Seth laid out, which was about a decade ago, and at the time was more of sort of a prediction of where the world was headed. And now, hey, it turns out, guess what? Seth was right. And I think one of the nice things your book does is sort of takes that initial premise and runs with it. And then updates it with all of the digital technology and advances we've had over the last decade, which are mind-blowing, and creates this new paradigm. So talk about how you took permission marketing and sort of build upon that idea, and what are the parallels and similarities, and what are some of the differences maybe?
Yeah, it's interesting you brought up that connection, because that's something my book agent actually said the same thing. She is actually an agent for Seth, and when she first read about the concept, she says, wow, this is really taking Seth's permission marketing to the next step. And I think, I was a reader of that when I started off my work in digital marketing way back when I started working at Procter & Gamble more than 10 years ago. One of the things I got to do was run Tide's digital program, which include about a 2 million person email database. What I think Seth did a great job of is introducing that concept of, you know, direct marketing is not pushing something onto people necessarily. It's, again, kind of getting their permission first and letting them know what you're offering at the beginning of that exchange. And I think that's, you know, again, something that has been taken in many directions, especially in digital, where you can have more of that relationship with people. But I think what's been missed is, and what's kind of happening now is that many people take that idea of permission marketing as just you have someone's okay. So instead of forcing a direct mail piece, you're kind of letting them know and getting some permission, getting an opt-in that they would want to receive it going forward. But what too many businesses have taken is they've stopped there. And they said, great, I've got permission to be in someone's inbox, so let me flood their inbox with sales offers and the kind of going back to the mindless type of marketing that just same message to everyone type style. One of the things that I'd love to hate, for example, is I joined the Banana Republic email list a couple of years ago when I started buying some more clothes there, and they now send me twice a week nothing but sales offers. And in fact, most of the offers are for things that I'm not interested in, like, you know, women's shoes and boots. And so that's, yes, permission marketing, but not really meaningful to my life. What would be interesting if you kind of take that further, and I think when you get into meaningful marketing, is the marketing team at a Banana Republic saying, what does he really need? What's the higher level needs that Bob has that we can fulfill that may just happen to be related to clothing and get him to open our email, to read it more often, and then have a much higher chance of buying something? And so I recently, in my blog, wrote an open letter to Banana Republic saying, hey, I would love to get tips on what to wear, what's in season. I'm a fashion victim. I'll wear white after Labor Day if someone, my wife, doesn't tell me. So lots of opportunities to create content. And again, maybe even with a GQ magazine or a Men's Health or a related publication. But I'd settle for just getting men's clothes at the same time. So, that's something where I think it's taking that meaningful marketing, starting not with we have permission to market, so let's do nothing but sell product, but then looking at what else can we do to help the person in their higher level goal. The reason they buy our clothes is to look good, you know, to look sharp, impress a client, what have you.
Well, and in the book, and it's sort of a great segue with your answer, but in the book, you talk a lot about 20th century psychologist Abraham Maslow and his framework of human needs, and that the bottom is the bottom of that pyramid is clothing and shelter and basic sort of human survival needs, and goes on up through to very complex things like self-actualization. And I think in the book you do a great job of tying in meaningful marketing with Maslow and his hierarchy of human needs. Talk about Maslow and his relevance to the world of marketing, particularly with meaningful marketing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, when I started working on this concept and book idea, really actually a little more than 3 years ago, kind of sat down and first started fleshing it out, I was looking for some way of organizing, an organizing framework for the concept of what does meaningful marketing mean. And I kind of went back to my old sociology 101 textbooks and kind of rediscovered Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which almost 60 years after he created it is still the best way for anyone to understand, you know, what are the different needs that people have. And we are, as humans, if anything, need-focused machines or software. Once we have one goal achieved, we go for the next one. And that's what's made us great technology and improve the world in many ways, improve ourselves. And so that's really what I've tried to do is mirror that idea of meaningful marketing, similar to how people look at their needs in Maslow's framework. So I've got a hierarchy of meaningful marketing that mirrors that. It starts at a very, way of three kind of levels of ways that brands can create meaningful marketing. First level I call solutions, which is about creating information and services that people find useful. And that's kind of the starting point. To be meaningful, you at least need to be, have a utility value for people. So a free sample, a coupon, information on your products on your website. I mean, those are all things that people are actually looking for and wanting information about. And that kind of mirrors Maslow's first level, which is around kind of give me the basics of survival, right? Food,
yep.
Shelter, water source, and that type of thing. From there, some brands go to the next highest level that I call meaningful connections. And this is often about creating entertaining experiences that people like to share. That mirrors Maslow's middle level, which is around kind of love and friendship and kind of mutual caring. If you look at that entertaining experiences that people share, things like Will It Blend, the series of videos showing throwing different objects into a blender for BlendTech.
I love those.
Seeing what happens. Very entertaining experience. It's fun. I mean, when you've got the information you need, you know, you're looking for that. What's new? What's different? What can make me think in a new way? Another example is anytime marketers allow customers to personalize their products. So M&M's allowing personalization. Jones Soda. We recently did something for Pringles at Bridge Worldwide where we allowed people to create their own wrapper for their Pringles cans, and people personalized it by uploading pictures of their child playing soccer and created it for different birthday parties and events. Those are all things that literally bring the brand to a tighter connection in people's minds because it's hitting on that higher level need and deeper meaning. And then finally, I've got the level that I call achievement marketing, which is really about, you know, helping people improve themselves, improve their family, and improve the world. And that mirrors Maslow's highest level around self-actualization, where people basically say, you know, I'm going to make a dent in the world, as Steve Jobs says. I want to make something meaningful for the world around me. And so that's, for marketers, great opportunities to help people learn a skill. If you take craft, for example, did a great job several years ago putting recipes online, right? That's very much that kind of solution, that lower level. Hey, I need something to cook tonight. Here's a recipe. But then in the past couple of years, they've actually put a lot of investment into creating online cooking training. So not just giving people a recipe, but teaching them to cook Mexican food or French food or, you know, create something for the higher in the holidays. Again, that's not just giving people a recipe. That's giving them a skill they can use for the rest of their life and be creative and be proud and make their family happy for years to come. And then cause-related marketing fits very well at that highest level where people do want to change the world. They do want to improve the world. And so when that's done really well, a lot of times it's not done well or not done in a meaningful way, but that can be a great return for brands by giving people the opportunity to improve the world around them.
So can any business use the philosophy of meaningful marketing, or is it more geared toward a specific type of business or industry? So, I mean, you know, for example, does a consumer products company have an increased ability to do this over, say, a plumber?
Really, from everything that I've seen and how I wrote the book is for any type of business or even organization to use it. I mean, I have several pages where I talk about examples of not-for-profits promoting their causes that they're working on through meaningful marketing instead of just, again, scare tactics on TV or print. The model that I've created is really starting out with what's your objective, what's an insight about your target customer, and then building strategies that put those together to add value to people's lives. So that can really be people in developed nations, in developing nations, B2B, B2C. And what I found, you know, as I've talked to some people who have read the book and followed the concept and continue to blog at marketingwithmeaning.com, is that in many ways, although I come from and daily work with big billion-dollar brands, in many ways it's much easier for entrepreneurs and B2B companies to do meaningful marketing. Many of them don't have the big budgets for traditional advertising. They're looking at costs extremely closely. And a lot of them are closer to their customers. So in B2B, you know, you've got a sales force that often knows every single customer by name. And so instead of sending them out an email continuously saying, buy more of our products, actually calling them up and giving them some content, giving them some articles or white papers or something that's going to help them be more successful at their job, that's how you get that foot in the door. And then really they want to repay you with their business. You see that again and again.
Well, some might argue, particularly in these difficult economic times, that marketing should not be concerned with meaning. So So spending money on causes and spending money on, you know, changing the world, it only increases costs, hurts the bottom line, and diminishes returns for investors. So the idea, you know, this philosophy would be, you know, the business of the business is business, not meaning. So how would you respond to that type of argument or that line of thought?
Yeah, in many ways that would seem to be the logical response or the logical thing that, that would happen is, and a lot of businesses have kind of gone through that and said, oh, people are getting tights on funds. You know, literally they were going, and we have some clients that were literally going back to their marketing textbooks and opening the chapter on the value equation and saying, you know, how do we improve the value equation? And the old textbook model is you've got the product benefits plus the brand equity divided by the price equals value to the customer. And so looking at that, you know, there's only a couple things that you can do, or maybe one thing you can do, right? You really don't want to take your price down. You can, but, you know, that's very tough because it hurts your long-term profitability and equity. You can do a bunch of commercials that say how great your brand is to try to build up brand equity, but that's extremely tough, and frankly, people aren't paying attention just to traditional interruptive commercials that, that say how great your brand is. Or you can add product benefits, and again, usually that means you've got to add some costs into your structure to upgrade it. So it's not really much to go from in the traditional model, but you know that hasn't stopped some brands from going back and doing traditional TV that, that talks about their product benefits. But what I think really the opportunity is to kind of rethink the entire value equation for business. And something that has been missing for years is putting marketing itself into that value equation for people. And that, to me, is that, that looking at marketing as something that could be meaningful. If you change that and say marketing, you know, is not an expense to just draw eyeballs about a product, but it's actually something that can make the product and brand seem more valuable to people, in a way you're able to take those current funds that you're spending on interruption and put them into that top line of the value equation to add value. And I think one of the examples where that's worked is that cause-related marketing is still performing very well. I mean, even in the depths of the recession a couple of months ago, cause-related marketing was building brands business. Sustainability marketing, something that some people predicted would decline quickly because of the economic pressures, that's, you know, maintained or improved over time. You know, people are basically just looking, especially with premium brands, right? You know, performance can't get much better, but when you're doing something like supporting an important cause, trying to improve the environment, or again, just giving a free sample, those are all very vivid examples of how the brand is adding more value to a customer's life. And I think, you know, there's $500 billion spent a year on interruptive marketing. If you just take a small share of that and add it into actually adding value, it can really move the needle, I think, for a lot of brands.
Well, another book that I recently read in addition to yours is Chris Anderson's Free. And so along sort of these same economic lines, chapter 3 of your book, you talk about the power of free. And one of the statistics that you actually quoted that jumped out at me was from a February 2007 study by the Promotion Marketing Association. I thought this was fascinating. So 9 out of 10 consumers say they would purchase a good or service if they experienced it and were satisfied with it. Talk about how free or free trials can create meaning without eroding margin. So how do you sort of give it away, but find that balance between not diminishing value or creating enough interest to then generate profit?
Sure. Well, in terms of not negatively hitting profit, I mean, I'm a big believer in this is about using your current marketing dollars in a different way. So this isn't going out and trying to convince your boss to spend another $10 million or whatever the case may be. So it's taking some of the budget that you've currently got and reinvesting it in different ways. And so with sampling to people, what that really in many cases means, again, for a traditional brand, they may be going out and trying to reach a million people a weekend with an ad. Well, what if it's and some small percentage pays attention, sees it, remembers it, and buys it at the store the next day? But if you look at it the other way around and say, how do we get, you know, 50, 100,000 people to, say, opt into a free sample, use it, have a good experience, and then be one of those 9 to 10 that actually end up going to the store, that can be a much more effective use of the dollars. And what happens there when you give a free sample, it's many, many, many things go through a consumer's mind. I mean, the first is the very basic, helps them over that trust issue of whether it's going to be good or not. And often, you know, the brands that are doing the most marketing have great products and, you know, really should be standing behind their products that they sell by offering to give one up for free. So it helps people through that kind of trust factor of getting their buy-in. It also helps just get their attention. So in the book Free, Chris Anderson talks a lot about the mentality of free, where we are programmed to respond to that magic word and try it even if we're not necessarily thinking about it or needing it right away. So that definitely gets people's attention whenever you're offering something. And then the third thing I think is really interesting, and again, going to back to psychology, is that we are programmed as people to have feelings of reciprocity. When a friend does something for us, we are programmed to remember that, even unconsciously, and want to repay that favor at some point. And the same thing happens with brands. When you're given something, you feel compelled to want to repay the brand, you know, with a purchase at some point down the line. And again, that's something traditional advertising doesn't do. In fact, it's some studies are starting to show the opposite, where people are saying, "Oh, you're interrupting me. I'm boycotting you. I don't want to be with you. You've stopped my, you know, sporting event to force a message down my throat." So a lot of these things, you know, it's really new for marketers to start thinking in psychology in this way of, you know, doing something for consumers instead of the psychology of interruption. But a lot of possibilities are unlocked, and it's great to see Chris Anderson promoting that idea too.
Yeah, I love one of the quotes, and I'm probably going to butcher it, but something along the lines of, in a digital world, there are two prices, free and everything else.
Yeah.
Which
exactly.
I got a kick out of.
Well, but you know what's interesting too, and what I would disagree with Chris a little bit is that everything has to be free. And one of the things I'm just kind of starting to collect some examples of is where there's marketing that people are actually paying for. One of my favorite examples is Sam Adams recently came out with a line of beer glasses that are actually kind of patterned after the idea of a good wine glass. And Ed Cook, their CEO, spent some time working with different wine glass manufacturers and created this glass that's got about four different ways to improve the experience of drinking a Sam Adams. It's got a curved neck, you know, that kind of puts your nose more into the beer so you can smell it. It's got laser etching on the bottom that releases a steady stream of bubbles that both looks good and brings more of the taste to the surface. And, you know, it's got a Sam Adams logo on it. And they're selling those glasses online for $30 for a set of four. And, you know, for me, when I saw that when it first came out, I snapped it up because I knew that, you know, I enjoyed my Sam Adams and wanted to try this for myself. And I also couldn't wait to, you know, when friends were over in my basement bar to let them try the new Sam Adams glass. So for Sam, they get someone who's even more of a fan of the beer, someone who's sharing a great experience with their friends, and a guy that paid $30 for the privilege to do all that.
Oh, absolutely.
I think another great example is Kraft. Back to Kraft, they launched an iPhone app about a year ago called iFood, which puts a lot of the content that they have on their website, recipes, cooking videos, shopping lists, onto the iPhone, and they decided to charge 99 cents for it. And what they said was, wow, we've got a really valuable tool here, and we want to both, you know, get some of the reward for the value, but also communicate to consumers that it is valuable. So in a way, their theory, and this is getting in that fuzzy area of economics, if you charge for something, you can get a higher demand for it and higher satisfaction because people feel that it, there is a value.
What role, and going along that idea of, you know, you mentioned a great example from Kraft using technology. What role does technology play in the future of marketing, and how can things like data actually create meaning?
Yeah, I think, I mean, overall, again, we could see technology going in either making new ways to interrupt you, new ways to read your mind, to place an interruptive ad in front of you, and there's certainly a lot of people working on that. But I think what's really exciting is, you know, how can you use technology to add more and more value? And I think that's what, you know, those of us who have been in the digital world for a long time, a lot lot of us, we didn't go into this because we wanted to do banner ads. We went into it because we wanted to create cool stuff, you know, that people would enjoy and like. And so things like, mobile applications that are coming up, I mean, that's, people aren't excited about creating new banner ads for that. It's exciting to create, you know, a Charmin sitter squat application and something that people actually find useful. And data in particular, what I think is really exciting is to, and again, that's where one of those, you know, moments of truth is going to happen. Will the data be used to kind of better target interruption, or will the data be used to add more value to people's lives? And I'd say, even going back to that example of, you know, a Banana Republic, I mean, they could, when data is more useful and when companies invest in making it more useful, because a lot of the stuff, the ways to use it is there. It's just companies making the call to whether they want to pay for it yet or not, or use it. But imagine what a Banana Republic could do, you know, knowing everything I've ever bought there. It could ask questions about what I've bought at other places. And then it could ask me questions about my job, or look at my LinkedIn profile. Oh, we see you're getting a new job somewhere. Here's some great tips, or, you know, you're moving. Here's what people are wearing in Arizona this spring. I mean, lots of different possibilities to use that data. Again, more and more, it's going to have to be with permission to be more meaningful.
One of the great things about the book is that every chapter has a lot of cases to support the premise, not only the overarching premise, but then the premise of the individual chapters. And one of my favorite cases that you cite in the book is that of Nike Plus. I've actually written about that on my blog myself. I use it all the time. I love it. And with this product, there were actually two companies, Apple and Nike, that teamed up to create something meaningful for consumers. So talk about why you think Nike Plus is such a great example of marketing with meaning, and then how both companies are actually leveraging this for success.
Yeah, I think that, you know, and for those who don't know, in a nutshell, Nike Plus is a system that it's special shoes from Nike. There's a sensor that goes in your left shoe. There's another sensor that plugs into your iPod. And basically what it does from there is it tracks, like a pedometer, it tracks how much you're running, the time that you've got. You can program it to record calories. And then when you sync your iPod, it uploads the information, and you can track how far you've run, trends. You can set goals for yourself. You can set challenges for friends. Really, really cool system that in many ways has brought a lot of – it's turned running into almost a video game and something that can help you really train to get better, whether you're trying to run a faster 5K or just trying to lose weight or trying to run a marathon. For years, Nike had been talking about, I'm a runner from way back, and I remember 15 years ago, Nike was talking about wanting to create the smart shoe, the shoe that could literally do what I'm talking about, count your calories, count your mileage. But finally, the opportunity came when the iPod was growing in popularity. They worked with Apple to actually make that dream a reality. And very seamless integration, and what it really does, I mean, it's great marketing for both companies, right? So for Nike, it's offering a tool that no one else had, a reason to trade up to the more expensive Nike Plus shoes. And then again, what it's really doing is bringing people into a Nike relationship marketing program where, you know, runners come in, they load up, and they want to go look at their profile. They're basically on Nike.com getting messages, getting content, as well as advertising about Nike products. For Apple, it's a great win because it's linking, you know, the brand to a hardcore user group. So runners are often listening to music, and so reaching that market with the iPod was a great opportunity for them. And then another way of adding value to the iPod. So as the Zune came in, as other music players are out there, you know, really only the Apple iPod works with Nike Plus, so it kind of locked people in. So great, great win-win for both. And an example, I talk about a section in the book about how brands can win by teaming up, really kind of looking at other brands as media partners, looking at other brands as ways to kind of fill out their marketing opportunities. One of my other favorite examples was the launch of the Simpsons movie. A couple of summers ago, they actually partnered with 7-Eleven to turn, I think, about a couple dozen 7-Eleven stores into Quickie Marts, which is the convenience store from the Simpsons show, and they had lines going around the block for people trying to get in and buy some of the actual products from the show, like the Homer Simpson's favorite donuts. It's funny, 7-Eleven admitted that at first when this idea came up, you know, everything was against it. Everyone in the room said, this is crazy. But eventually they kept thinking about it and talking about it and saw that, you know, yeah, it's different, it's weird, but this will get people talking about 7-Eleven. And it ended up being a huge win for both properties.
Well, your book taps into your experience both as a brand manager at P&G and chief strategist at Bridge Worldwide, and I would guess it's probably safe to assume that much of the book's contents were in your head prior to actually sitting down, firing up the laptop, or opening up the notebook and actually getting it down on paper. I'm curious, though, as to what you learned from writing the book in itself. So what assumptions you had initially going in were maybe changed or tweaked or modified, and why?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it does take a while. Like I said, about 3 years ago is when I started it. You know, I think the thing that is, and the book is a great example of the concept, and I think anyone who's looking to go in this direction will find a lot of use out of it. But, you know, like any book, you know, it's kind of a frozen in time. And, you know, as I've gone through, I think one of the things that I would probably spend more time on, and I will now in my blog, where I can kind of keep the conversation going with readers and people who are interested in the topic, is this idea of, you know, this is, yes, it's important to build a business, but in many ways, meaningful marketing improves our lives as marketers. It's a little bit something selfish that I have. I mean, I want to do things in my life that are important, that are meaningful. And frankly, I enjoy making, you know, working on strategy for websites for people who are trying to learn how to deal with diabetes. I like that a lot more than my days of making television ads, even, you know, at fun shoots in Los Angeles. You know, it makes me have a lot more fun coming into work in the morning and be much more proud at the end of the day when I know that the marketing I'm working on is going to make people smile, going to make them improve their life and in some ways save their lives. And so that's something that I really only touched in the book at the end in the epilogue, because frankly I was concerned that that would turn people off a little bit, that, you know, it's a little bit too high and mighty and preachy when people do have a business to run and need to focus on that. And that was something I got some feedback from a reader recently. He says, wow, I would have loved a whole book just on that point. So that's something that, you know, I think I'm going to keep in mind more, and maybe that's the sequel. Who knows?
Well, where can people go to find out more?
Well, I'm marketingwithmeaning.com is where I've got kind of the basis home for book reviews, links to buy. I do three blog posts a week of just different topics or things that kind of have found since then. And I've got a Twitter feed on there as well where I try to share a stream of just different articles and links and examples of marketers who are doing it well and not so well at the same time.
And I believe also, if I remember correctly, you're also on changethis.com with a manifesto?
Yeah, just last week launched the Change This Manifesto. The book itself is really on an entire model of marketing for, you know, whether you're doing PR, out of home, whatever. With the Change This Manifesto that recently went up, I really kind of honed in on meaningful digital strategy, kind of really hitting that point of there's a lot of marketers out there saying, what do I do in digital? And again, kind of wondering, is it all about making, you know, better banner ads or interruption? And really what I call for in the manifesto is digital marketing should be first and foremost about creating useful services for people.
Well, again, the book is The Next Evolution of Marketing, Connect with Your Customers by Marketing with Meaning. And the author, Bob Gilbreth, has been the guest today. Bob, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to share all of your insights and wisdom with me today. So thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me. Great question.
My thanks again go out to Bob Gilbreth for spending time sharing some great information with us. My thanks also go out to you, the listener, for spending some time listening to this podcast today. Please share with others and come back and visit again. For more information on Bob Gilbreth's book, visit marketingwithmeaning.com. Thank you.